centuries. At the darker end of pessimism, a wind-torn 4 degrees allows for flood and drought calamity and all of turmoil's dark political weather. More narrative tension in subplots of local interest. Will the Middle East remain in frenzy? Will it empty into Europe and alter it for good? Might Islam dip a feverish extremity in the cooling pond of Reformation? Might Israel concede an inch or two of desert to those it displaced? Europa's secular dreams of union may dissolve before the old hatreds, small-scale nationalism, financial disaster, discord. Or she might halt her course. I need to know. Will the USA decline quietly? Unlikely. Will China grow a conscience? Will Russia? Will global finance and corporations? Then bring on the seductive human constants. All of sex and art, wine and science, cathedrals, landscape, the higher pursuit of meaning. Finally, the private ocean of desires. Mine, to be barefoot on a beach round an open fire, grilled fish, juice of lemons, music, the company of friends, someone, not Trudy, to love me. My birthright in a book. So I'm ashamed of the attempt, relieved to have failed. Claude, now loudly humming in the echoing bathroom, must be reached by other means. Barely 15 minutes have passed since he undressed my mother. I sense we're entering a new phase of the evening. Over the sound of running taps, he calls out that he's hungry. With a degrading episode behind her and her pulse settling, I believe my mother will be returning to her theme of innocence. To her, Claude's talk of dinner will seem misplaced, even callous. She sits up, pulls on her dress, finds her knickers in the bedclothes, steps into her sandals, and goes to her dressing table mirror. She begins to braid the hair that, untended, hangs in blonde curls her husband once celebrated in a poem. This gives her time to recover and to think. She'll use the bathroom when Claude has left it. The idea of being near him repels her now. Disgust restores to her a notion of purity and purpose. Hours ago, she was in charge. She could be so again, as long as she resists another sickly, submissive swoon. She's fine for now. She's refreshed, sated, immune. But it waits for her. The little beastie could swell once more into a beast, distort her thoughts, drag her down, and she'll be Claude's. To take charge, however. I think of her musing as she tilts her lovely face before the mirror to twist another strand. To give orders, as she did this morning in the kitchen, devise the next step will be to own the offence. If only she could settle down to the blameless grief of the stricken widow. For now, there are practical tasks. All tainted utensils, plastic cups, the blender itself to be disposed of far from home. The kitchen to be scoured of traces. Only the coffee cups to remain in place on the table, unwashed. These dull chores will keep the horror at a distance for an hour. Perhaps this is why she puts a reassuring hand on the knoll that contains me, near the small of my back. A gesture of loving hope for our future. How could she think of giving me away? She'll need me. I'll brighten the penumbra of innocence and pathos she'll want around her. Mother and child, a great religion has spun its best stories around this potent symbol. Sitting on her knee, pointing skywards, I'll render her immune to prosecution. On the other hand, how I hate that phrase, no preparations have been made for my arrival. No clothes, no furniture, no compulsive nest-making. I've never knowingly been in a shop with my mother. The loving future is a fantasy. Claude emerges from the bathroom and goes towards the phone. Food is on his mind, an Indian takeaway, so he murmurs. She steps round him and sets about her own ablutions. When we emerge, he's still on the phone. He's abandoned Indian for Danish, open sandwiches, pickled herring, baked meats. He's over-ordering, a natural impulse after a murder. By the time he's finished, Trudy is ready, braided, washed, clean underwear, new frock, shoes in place of sandals, a dab of scent. She's taking charge. There's an old canvas bag in the cupboard under the stairs. I'm eating first, I'm starved. Go now, they could be back at any time. I'll do this my way.
You'll do as you're...
Was she really going to say told? What a distance she's travelled, treating him like a child, when just now she was his pet. He might have ignored her. There might have been a row, but what he's doing now is picking up the phone. It's not the Danish people confirming his order. It's not even the same phone. My mother has gone to stand behind him to look. It's not the landline, but the video entry phone. They're staring at the screen in wonder. The voice comes through, distorted, bereft of lower registers, a thin, penetrating plea.
Please, I need to see you now.
Oh, God!
My mother says in plain disgust.
Not now!
But Claude, still irritated by being ordered around, has reason to assert his autonomy. He presses the button, replaces the phone, and there's a moment's silence. They have nothing to say to each other. Or too much. Then we all go downstairs to greet the owl poet. 14. While we descend the stairs, I have time to reflect further on my fortunate lack of resolve, on the self-strangler's self-defeating loop. Some endeavours are doomed at their inception, not by cowardice, but by their very nature. Franz Reichelt, the flying tailor, fatally leapt from the Eiffel Tower in 1912, wearing a baggy parachute suit, certain his invention could save the lives of aviators. For 40 seconds he paused before the jump. When at last he tilted forward and stepped into the void, the updraft wrapped the fabric tightly round his body, and he fell just as a stone would fall. The facts, the mathematics, were against him. At the foot of the tower he made a shallow grave in the frozen Parisian ground, 15 centimetres deep. Which brings me, at Trudy's slow U-turn on the first landing, via death, to the matter of revenge. It's coming clearer, and I'm relieved. Revenge. The impulse is instinctive, powerful, and forgivable. Insulted, duped, maimed, no one can resist the allure of vengeful brooding. And here, far out at this extreme, a loved one murdered, the fantasies are incandescent. We're social. We once kept each other at bay by violence or its threat, like dogs in a pack. We're born to this delectable anticipation. What's an imagination for but to play out and linger on and repeat the bloody possibilities? Revenge may be exacted 100 times over in one sleepless night. The impulse, the dreaming intention, is human, normal, and we should forgive ourselves. But the raised hand, the actual violent enactment, is cursed. The maths says so. There'll be no reversion to the status quo ante, no balm, no sweet relief, or none that lasts. Only a second crime. Before you embark on a journey of revenge, dig 2 graves, Confucius said. Revenge unstitches a civilization. It's a reversion to constant, visceral fear. Look at the miserable Albanians, chronically cowed by Kanun, their idiot cult of blood feuds. So even as we reach the landing outside my precious father's library, I've absolved myself, not of thoughts, but of actions, of avenging his death in this life or in the postnatal next. And I'm absolving myself of cowardice. Claude's elimination won't restore my father. I'm extending Reichelt's 40-second hesitation into a lifetime. No to impetuous action. If I'd succeeded with a cord, then it, not Claude, would have been the cause for any pathologist to note. An unhappy accident, he'd record, and not unusual. There'd be some undeserved relief for my mother and uncle. If the stairs allow such room for thought, it's because Trudy is taking them at the pace of the slowest Loris. For once, her hand holds the banister tightly. She takes 1 step at a time, pauses on some, considers, sighs. I know how things stand. The visitor will hold up the essential housework. The police could return. Trudy's in no mood for a battle of jealous possession. There's an issue of precedence. She's been usurped at the identification of the body. That rankles. Elodie is merely a recent lover, or not so recent. She might have preceded the move to Shoreditch, another raw wound to dress. But why call round here? Not to receive or give comfort. She might know or possess some damning titbit. She could throw Trudy and Claude to the dogs, or it's blackmail. Funeral arrangements to discuss. None of that. No, no. For my mother, so much effortful negation. How wearying, on top of all else, a hangover, a murder, enervating sex, advanced pregnancy, for my mother to be obliged to exert her will and extend fulsome hatred to a guest. But she's determined. Her braids tightly conceal her thoughts from all but me, while her underwear, cotton, not silk, I sense, and a short summer print dress, correctly loose but not voluminous, are freshly in place. Her bare pink arms and legs, her purple-painted toenails, her full, unarguable beauty, are on intimidating display. Her aspect is of a ship of a line, fully, though reluctantly rigged, gun hatches lowered. A woman of war, of which I'm the bow's proud figurehead. She descends in floating but intermittent movements. She'll rise to whatever comes at her. By the time we reach the hallway, it's already started, and badly. The front door has opened and closed. Elodie is in, and in Claude's arms.
"Yes, yes, there, there,"
he murmurs into her succession of teary, broken sentences.
I shouldn't. It's wrong, but I'm sorry. What it must be. For you, I can't. Your brother. I can't help it."
My mother stays at the foot of the stairs, stiffening with distrust not only of the visitor. So, it's bardic distress. Elodie is not yet aware of us. Her face must be towards the door. The news she wants to deliver comes in staccato sobs.
"Tomorrow night, 50 poets from all over. We loved him. Reading in Bethnal, Green Library, or outside. Candles, one poem each. We so want you to be..."
She stops to blow her nose. To do so, she disengages from Claude and sees Trudy.
"50 poets,"
he helplessly repeats. What notion could be more repugnant to him?
"That's a lot."
Her sobs are almost under control, but the pathos of her own words brings them on again.
"Oh, hello, Trudy. I'm so sorry. If you could say a few... But we'd understand. If you can... How hard..."
We lose her to her grief, which rises in pitch to a kind of cooing. She tries to apologise, and at last we hear...
"Compared to what you... So sorry. Not my place."
She's right, as Trudy sees it. Usurped again. Out-griefed, out-wailed, she remains unmoved by the stairs. Here in the hallway, where the remains of a stench must still linger, we're held in social limbo. We listen to Elodie, and the seconds go by. What now? Claude has the answer.
"We'll go down. There's Puy Fumé in the fridge." "I don't. I just came to... This way."
As Claude guides her past my mother, a look must surely pass between them. That is, her flashed rebuke must meet his bland shrug. The two women don't embrace, or even touch or speak when they're inches apart. Trudy lets them get ahead before she follows down into the kitchen, where the two accusers, Glycol and Judd Street Smoothie, hide in forensic smears among the chaos.
"If you'd like,"
my mother says as she sets foot on the sticky floorboards. "I'm sure Claude will make you a sandwich." This innocent offer conceals many barbs. It's inappropriate to the occasion. Claude has never made a sandwich in his life. There's no bread in the house. Nothing to set between two slabs but the dust of salted nuts. and who could safely eat a sandwich from such a kitchen? Pointedly, she doesn't propose making it herself. Pointedly, she casts Elodie and Claude together, distinct from herself. It's an accusation, a rejection, a cold withdrawal bundled into a hospitable gesture. Even as I disapprove, I'm impressed. Such refinements can't be learned from podcasts. Trudy's hostility has a beneficial effect on Elodie's syntax.
I can eat a thing, thank you.
You could drink a thing, says Claude.
I could.
There follows the familiar suite of sounds. The fridge door, a careless chink of corkscrew against bottle, the cork sonorous withdrawal, last night's glasses sluiced under the tap. Puy, just across the river from Sancerre. Why not? It's almost 7:30. The little grapes with their misty grey bloom should suit us well on another hot and airless London evening. But I want more. It seems to me that Trudy and I have not eaten in a week. Stirred by Claude's phone order, I crave, as accompaniment, an overlooked old-fashioned dish, areng pomme à l'huile, slippery smoked herring, waxy new potatoes, the first pressing of the finest olives, onion, chopped parsley. I pine for such an entree. How elegantly a Puy fumé would set it off. But how to persuade my mother? I could as easily slit my uncle's throat. The graceful country of my third choice has never seemed so far away. All of us are at the table now. Claude pours, glasses are raised, in sombre tribute to the dead. Into the silence, Elodie says in an awed whisper,
"But suicide, it just seems so... so unlike him."
"Oh, well," says Trudy, and lets that hang. She's seen an opportunity. "How long have you known him?"
"2 years, when he taught."
"Then you wouldn't know about the depressions." My mother's quiet voice pushes against my heart. What solace for her, to have faith in a coherent tale of mental illness and suicide.
"My brother wasn't exactly one for the primrose path."
Claude, I begin to understand, is not a liar of the first rank.
"I didn't know,"
Elodie says in a small voice.
"He was always so generous, especially to us, you know, younger generation, who..."
"A whole other side," Trudy sets this down firmly. "I'm glad his students never saw it."
"Even as a child," says Claude, "he once took a hammer to our..."
"This isn't the time for that story." Trudy has made it more interesting by cutting it short.
"You're right," he says. "We loved him anyway."
I feel my mother's hand go up to her face to cover it or brush away a tear.
"But he'd never get treatment. He couldn't accept that he was ill."
There's protest or complaint in Elodie's voice that my mother and uncle won't like.
"It doesn't make any sense. He was on his way to Luton to pay the printer in cash. He was so happy to be settling a debt. And he was reading tonight, King's College Poetry Society. Three of us were like, you know, the supporting band."
"He loved his poems,"
Claude says. Elodie's tone rises with her anguish.
"Why would he pull over and... just like that, when he'd finished his book? And been shortlisted for the Auden Prize?"
"Depression's a brute."
Claude surprises me with this insight.
"All the good things in life vanish from you..."
My mother cuts in. Her voice is hard. She's had enough. "I know you're younger than me, but do I really have to spell it out for you? Company in debt, personally in debt, unhappy with his work, child on the way he didn't want, wife fucking his brother, chronic skin complaint, and depression. Is that clear? You think it isn't bad enough without your theatrics, without your poetry readings and prizes, and telling me it doesn't make sense? You got into his bed. Count yourself lucky." Trudy, in turn, is cut off by a shriek and the smack of a chair tipping backwards to the floor. I note at this point that my father has receded. Like a particle in physics, he escapes definition in his flight from us. The assertive, successful poet-teacher-publisher, calmly intent on repossessing his house, his father's house, or the hapless put-upon cuckold, the unworldly fool cramped by debt and misery and lack of talent. The more we hear of one, the less we believe of the other. Elodie's first uttered sound is both a word and a sob.
Never!
A silence, through which I sense Claude, then my mother, reaching for their drinks.
I didn't know what he was going to say last night. All untrue. He wanted you back. He was trying to make you jealous. He was never going to throw you out.
Her voice dips as she bends to right the chair.
That's why I'm here, to tell you. And you better get this right. Nothing, nothing happened between us. John Cairncross was my editor and friend and teacher. He helped me become a writer. Is that clear?
I'm heartlessly suspicious, but they believe her. That she was not my father's lover should be a deliverance for them, but I think it raises other possibilities. An inconvenient woman bearing witness to all the reasons my father had to live. How unfortunate. Sit down, Trudy says quietly. I believe you. No more shouting, please. Claude refills the glasses. The Puy Fumé seems to me too thin, too piercing. Too young, perhaps, not right for the occasion. Summer evening heat aside, a muscular Pomerol might suit us better when strong emotions are on display. If only there was a cellar, if I could go down there now into the dusty gloom to pull a bottle off the racks. Stand quietly with it a moment, squint at its label, nod wisely to myself as I bring it up. Adult life, a faraway oasis, not even a mirage. I imagine my mother's bare arms folded on the table, eyes steady and clear. No one could guess at her torment. John loved only her. His invocation of Dubrovnik was sincere. His declaration of hatred, his dreams of strangling her, his love for Elodie, all hopeful lies. But she mustn't go down. She must be staunch. She's putting herself in a mood of serious probing, seemingly not unfriendly. You identified the body. Elodie is also calmer.
They tried to get hold of you.
No reply.
They had his phone. They saw his calls to me. About the reading tonight. Nothing else. I asked my fiancé to go with me. I was so scared.
How did he look?
She means John, Claude says.
I was surprised. He looked peaceful, except...
She draws a sharp inward sigh.
Except his mouth. It was so long, so wide, stretched almost ear to ear, like an insane smile. It was closed, though. I was glad about that.
Around me, in the walls and through the crimson chambers that lie beyond them, I feel my mother tremble. One more physical detail like this will undo her. 15. Early in my conscious life, one of my fingers, not then subject to my influence, brushed past a shrimp-like protuberance between my legs. And though shrimp and fingertip lay at differing distances from my brain, they felt each other simultaneously, a diverting issue in neuroscience known as the binding problem. Days later, it happened again on another finger. Some developmental time passed, and I grasped the implications. Biology is destiny, and destiny is digital, and in this case, binary. It was bleakly simple. The strangely essential matter at the heart of every birth was now settled. Either or. Nothing else. No one exclaims at the moment of one's dazzling coming out, "It's a person." Instead, "It's a girl. It's a boy." Pink or blue. A minimal improvement on Henry Ford's offer of cars of any colour, so long as they were black. Only two sexes. I was disappointed. If human bodies, minds, fates are so complex, if we are free like no other mammal, why limit the range? I seethed, and then, like everyone else, I settled down and made the best of my inheritance. For sure, complexity would come upon me in time. Until then, my plan was to arrive as a free-born Englishman, a creature of the post-English as well as Scottish and French Enlightenment. My selfhood would be sculpted by pleasure, conflict, experience, ideas, and my own judgment, as rocks and trees are shaped by rain, wind, and time. Besides, in my confinement, I had other concerns. My drink problem, family worries, an uncertain future in which I faced a possible jail sentence or a life in care in the careless lap of Leviathan, fostered up to the 13th floor. But lately, as I track my mother's shifting relation to her crime, I've remembered rumours of a new dispensation in the matter of blue and pink. Be careful what you wish for. Here's a new politics in university life. This digression may seem unimportant, but I intend to apply as soon as I can. Physics, Gaelic, anything. So I'm bound to take an interest. A strange mood has seized the almost educated young. They're on the march, angry at times, but mostly needful, longing for authority's blessing, its validation of their chosen identities. The decline of the West in new guise, perhaps, or the exaltation and liberation of the self. A social media site famously proposes 71 gender options. Neutral, two-spirit, bigender, any colour you like, Mr. Ford. Biology is not destiny after all, and there's cause for celebration. A shrimp is neither limiting nor stable. I declare my undeniable feeling for who I am. If I turn out to be white, I may identify as black, and vice versa. I may announce myself as disabled, or disabled in context. If my identity is that of a believer, I'm easily wounded, my flesh torn to bleeding by any questioning of my faith. Offended, I enter a state of grace. Should inconvenient opinions hover near me like fallen angels or evil jinn, a mile being too near, I'll be in need of the special campus safe room, equipped with Play-Doh and looped footage of gambling puppies. Ah, the intellectual life. I may need advance warning if upsetting books or ideas threaten my very being by coming too close, breathing on my face, my brain, like unwholesome dogs. I'll feel, therefore I'll be. Let poverty go begging and climate change braise in hell. Social justice can drown in ink. I'll be an activist of the emotions, a loud, campaigning spirit fighting with tears and sighs to shape institutions around my vulnerable self. My identity will be my precious, my only true possession, my access to the only truth. The world must love, nourish, and protect it as I do. If my college does not bless me, validate me, and give me what I clearly need, I'll press my face into the Vice-Chancellor's lapels and weep, then demand his resignation. The womb, or this womb, isn't such a bad place. A little like the grave, fine and private, in one of my father's favourite poems. I'll make a version of a womb for my student days. Set aside the enlightenments of rosbifs, jocks and frogs. Away with the real, with dull facts and hated pretense of objectivity. Feeling is queen, unless she identifies as king. I know. Sarcasm ill suits the unborn. And why digress? Because my mother is in step with new times. She may not know it, but she marches with a movement. Her status as a murderer is a fact, an item in the world outside herself. But that's old thinking. She affirms, she identifies, as innocent. Even as she strains to clean up traces in the kitchen, she feels blameless, and therefore is. Almost. Her grief, her tears, are proof of probity. She's beginning to convince herself with her story of depression and suicide. She can almost believe the sham evidence in the car. Only persuade herself, and she'll deceive with ease and consistency. Lies will be her truth. But her construction is new and frail. My father's ghastly smile could upend it. That knowing grin coldly stretched across a corpse's face. That's why it's needed, Elodie's validation of my mother's innocent self. And why she leans forward now, taking me with her, listening tenderly to the poet's halting words. For Elodie will soon be in interview with the police. Her beliefs, which will direct her memory and order her account, must be properly shaped. Claude, unlike Trudy, owns his crime. This is a Renaissance man, a Machiavel, an old-school villain who believes he can get away with murder. The world doesn't come to him through a haze of the subjective. It comes refracted by stupidity and greed, bent as through glass or water, but etched on a screen before the inner eye, a lie as sharp and bright as truth. Claude doesn't know he's stupid. If you're stupid, how can you tell? He may blunder through an undergrowth of clichés, but he understands what he did and why. He'll flourish without a backward glance, unless caught and punished, and then he'll never blame himself, only his bad luck among random events. He can claim his inheritance, his tenure among the rational. Enemies of the Enlightenment will say he's the embodiment of its spirit. Nonsense. But I know what they mean. 16. Elodie eludes me, like a half-remembered song, an unfinished melody indeed. When she squeezed by us in the hall, when she was still in our thoughts my father's girl, I listened out for the alluring creak of leather. But no, today she's dressed in softer style, more colourfully, I think. She would have cut a figure at the poetry event tonight. When she was wailing in distress, her voice was pure. But her account of the visit to the mortuary, clutching at her fiancé's wrist, was a reminder, as each growling sentence trailed away, of the guttural urbane, her tasty fry-up. Now, as my mother extends an arm across the kitchen table to enfold the visitor's hand in hers, I hear in the vowels the duck's quack restored. Elodie's relaxing into my mother's confidence as she, the poet, praises my father's poems. It's the sonnets she loves most.
He wrote them in a conversational style, but dense with meaning, and so musical.
Her use of tense is correct, but offensive. She speaks as if the death of John Cairncross has been fully confirmed, absorbed, publicly acknowledged, historically beyond grief like the sack of Rome. Trudy will mind more than I do. I've been conditioned to believe his poetry was a dud. Today, everything is up for revaluation. Her voice grave with insincerity, Trudy says,
"It will be a long time before we have the full measure of him as a poet."
Oh, yes, but we already know something. Beyond Hughes, up there with Fenton, Heaney and Plath. "Names to conjure with," says Claude.
This is my Elodie problem. What is she doing here? She dances like a wild corribant, in and out of focus. Overpraising my father may be a style of comforting my mother. If so, that's poorly conceived. Or sorrow distorts her judgment. That's forgivable. Or her self-importance is bound up with her patrons. That's not. Or she's come to find out who killed her lover. That's interesting. Should I like her? Or distrust her? My mother loves her and won't let go of her hand.
You'll know this better than I do. Talent on that scale comes at a cost. Not only to himself. Kind to everyone who isn't close. Strangers too. And people saying almost as kind as Heaney. Not that I ever knew or read him. But just below the surface, John was in agony.
No.
Self-doubt, constant mental pain, lashing out at those he loved, but cruelest to himself. Then the poem gets written at last.
And then the sun comes out.
Claude has caught his sister-in-law's drift. She says loudly over him,
"That conversational style, one long bloody battle to wrench it from his soul."
Oh?
Personal life wrecked. And now?
She chokes up on the tiny word that contains the fateful present. On such a day of revaluation, I could be wrong. But I always thought my father composed fast, with reproachable ease. It was held against him in the review he once read aloud to prove his indifference.
I heard him say it to my mother during one of his sad visits. If it doesn't come at once, it shouldn't come. There's a special grace in facility. All art aspires to the condition of Mozart's. Then he laughed at his own presumption. Trudy won't remember. And she'll never know that even as she lied about my father's mental health, his poetry raised her diction. Lashing out, wrench, soul, borrowed clothes. But they've made an impression. Cold mother, she knows what she's about. Elodie whispers, I never knew. Then another silence. Trudy waits intensely, like an angler whose fly is sweetly placed. Claude starts a word, a mere vowel, severed, I'd guess, by her glance. Our visitor begins dramatically. All John's instructions are engraved in my heart. When to break a line. Never randomly stay at the helm. Make sense, a unit of sense. Decide, decide, decide. And know your scansion, so you disrupt the beat knowingly. Then, form isn't a cage, it's an old friend you can only pretend to leave. And feelings, he'd say, don't unpack your heart, one detail tells the truth. Also, write for the voice, not the page, write for the untidy evening in the parish hall. He made us read James Fenton on the genius of the trochee. Afterwards, he set the assignment for the week ahead, a poem in four stanzas of trochaic tetrameter's catalectic. We laughed at this gobbledygook. He had us singing an example, a nursery rhyme. Boys and girls come out to play. Then he recited from memory Auden's autumn song. Now the leaves are falling fast, nurse's flowers will not last. Why is the missing syllable at the end of the line so effective? We can answer him. Then what about a poem with the weak syllable restored? Wendy speeded my undressing. Wendy is the sheets caressing. He knew the whole of Betjeman's indoor games near Newbury. It made us giggle. So for that assignment, I wrote the first of my owl poems in that same meter of autumn song. He made us learn our own strongest poems by heart. So we'd be bold at our first reading, stand on stage without our pages. The idea made me nearly faint with fear. Listen, now I'm slipping into trochees. Talk of scansion is of interest only to me. I sense my mother's impatience. This has gone on too long. If I had breath to hold, I'd hold it now. He bought us drinks, lent us money we never gave back, heard us out on boyfriend-girlfriend trouble, fights with parents, so-called writer's block. He stood bail for one drunken would-be poet in our group. He wrote letters to get us grants or humble jobs on literary pages. We loved the poets he loved. His opinions became our own. We listened to his radio talks. We went to the readings he sent us to. And we went to his own. We knew his poems, his anecdotes, his catchphrases. We thought we knew him. It never crossed our minds that John, the grown-up, the high priest, had problems too, or that he doubted his poetry just as we did ours. We mostly worried about sex and money. Nothing like his agony. If only we'd known. The fly was taken, the shortening line was taut and trembling, and now the catch is in the keep net. I feel my mother relax. That mysterious particle, my father, is gaining mass, growing in seriousness and integrity. I'm caught between pride and guilt. In a brave, kind voice, Trudy says, It would have made no difference. You mustn't blame yourself. We knew everything, Claude and I. We tried everything. Claude, stirred by the sound of his name, clears his throat.
Beyond help. His own worst enemy.
Before you go, says Trudy, there's a little something I want you to have.
We climb the stairs to the hall and then to the first floor, my mother and I moving lugubriously, Elodie close behind. The purpose must surely be to let Claude gather up whatever he must dispose of. Now we're standing in the library.
I hear the young poet's intake of breath as she looks around at three walls of poetry.
I'm sorry it smells so musty in here.
Already. The books, the library air itself, in mourning.
I'd like you to take one.
Oh, I couldn't. Shouldn't you keep it all together?
I want you to. So would he.
And so we wait while she decides. Elodie is embarrassed and therefore quick. She returns to show her choice.
John's put his name in it. Peter Porter. The Cost of Seriousness. It's got an exequy. Tetrameters again. Most beautiful. Oh yes, he came to dinner once. I think.
On that last word, the doorbell sounds. Louder, longer than usual. My mother tenses. Her heart begins to pound. What is it she dreads?
I know you'll have a lot of visitors. Thank you, so...
Shh! We go quietly onto the landing. Trudy leans cautiously over the banisters. Careful now. Distantly, we hear Claude talking on the videophone, then his footsteps ascending from the kitchen.
Oh, hell!
My mother whispers.
Are you all right? Do you need to sit down?
I think I do.
We retreat, the better to be concealed from the front door's line of sight. Elodie helps my mother into the cracked leather armchair in which she used to daydream while her husband recited to her. We hear the front door open, the murmur of voices, the door closing. Then only one set of footsteps coming back along the hall. Of course, the Danish takeaway. The open sandwiches, my dream of herring about to be fulfilled, in part. All this Trudy recognises, too.
I'll see you out.
Downstairs, at the door, just as Elodie is leaving, she turns to say to Trudy,
I'm due at the police station tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock. I'm so sorry, it's going to be hard for you. Just tell them everything you know.
I will. Thank you. Thank you for this book.
They embrace and kiss, and she's gone. My guess is that she's got what she came for. We return to the kitchen. I'm feeling strange, famished, exhausted, desperate. My worry is that Trudy will tell Claude that she can't face eating, not after the doorbell. Fear is an emetic. I'll die unborn, a meagre death. But she and I and hunger are one system, and sure enough, the tin-foil boxes are ripped apart. She and Claude eat fast, standing by the kitchen table, where yesterday's coffee cups might still be. He says, through stuffed mouth,
All packed and ready to go?
Pickled herring, gherkin, a slice of lemon on pumpernickel bread. They don't take long to reach me. Soon, I'm whipped into alertness by a keen essence saltier than blood. By the tang of sea spray off the wide open ocean road where lonely herring shoals skim northwards through clean black icy water. It keeps coming, a chilling Arctic breeze pouring over my face as though I stood boldly in the prow of a fearless ship, heading into glacial freedom. That is, Trudy eats one open sandwich after another, on and on, until she takes a first bite of her last and throws it down. She's reeling. She needs a chair. She groans.
Oh, that was good. Look, tears. I'm crying with pleasure.
I'll be off, Claude says. And you can cry alone.
For a long time, I've been almost too big for this place. Now, I'm too big. My limbs are folded hard against my chest. My head is wedged into my only exit. I wear my mother like a tight-fitting cap. My back aches. I'm out of shape. My nails need cutting. I'm beat, lingering in that dusk where torpor doesn't cancel thought, but freeze it. Hunger, then sleep. One need fulfilled, another takes its place. Ad infinitum, until the needs become mere whims, luxuries. Something in this goes near the heart of our condition. But that's for others. I'm pickled.
The herrings are bearing me away. I'm on the shoulders of the giant shoal, heading north, and when I'm there, I'll hear the music not of seals and groaning ice, but of vanishing evidence, of running taps, the popping of foaming suds. I'll hear the midnight chime of pots and chairs upended on the kitchen table to reveal the floor and its scattered burden of food crumbs, human hair, and mouse shit. Yes, I was there when he tempted her again to bed, called her his mouse, pinched her nipples hard, filled her cheeks with his lying breath and cliché bloated tongue. And I did nothing. 17. I wake into near silence to find myself horizontal. As always, I listen carefully. Beyond the patient tread of Trudy's heart, beyond her breathing sighs and faintest creak of ribcage, are the murmurs and trickles of a body maintained by hidden networks of care and regulation, like a well-run city in the dead of night. Beyond the walls, the rhythmic commotion of my uncle's snoring, quieter than usual. Beyond the room, no sound of traffic. In another time, I would have turned as best I could and sunk back into dreamlessness. Now, one splinter, one pointed truth from the day before, punctures the delicate tissue of sleep. Then everything, everyone, the small willing cast, slips in through the tear. Who's first? My smiling father. The new and difficult rumour of his decency and talent. The mother I'm bound to, and bound to love and loathe. Priapic, satanic, Claude. Elodie, scanning poet, untrustworthy dactyl. And cowardly me, self-absolved of revenge, of everything but thought. These five figures turn before me, playing their parts in events exactly as they were, and then as they might have been, and might yet be. I've no authority to direct the action. I can only watch. Hours pass. Later, I'm woken by voices. I'm on a slope, which suggests my mother is sitting up in bed, propped by pillows. The traffic outside is not yet at its usual density. My guess is 6 a.m. My first concern is that we might be due a matutinal visit to the Wall of Death. But no, they aren't even touching. Conversation only. They've had pleasure enough to last till noon, at least, which opens an opportunity now for rancour or reason, or even regret. They've chosen the first. My mother is speaking in the flat tone she reserves for her resentments. The first complete sentence I understand is this. If you weren't in my life, John would be alive today. Claude considers.
Likewise, if you weren't in mine.
A silence follows this blocking move. Trudy tries again. You turned silly games into something else, bringing that stuff into the house.
The stuff you made him drink.
If you hadn't...
Listen, dearest.
The endearment is mostly menace. He draws breath and considers yet again. He knows he must be kind, but kindness without desire, without promise of erotic reward, is difficult for him. The strain is in his throat.
It's fine. Not a criminal matter. We're on course. That girl's going to say all the right things.
Thanks to me.
Thanks to you is right. Death certificate, fine. Will, fine. Creme and all the trimmings, fine. Baby and house sale, fine.
But 4.5 million
is fine. In case of worst case, the plan B plan, fine.
Only syntax might make one think that I'm for sale. But I'll be free at the point of delivery. Or worthless. Trudy repeats with contempt. 4.5 million.
Fast. No questions.
A lover's catechism, which they may have been round before. I'm not always listening. She says, why the hurry?
He says, in case things go wrong.
She says, why should I trust you?
He says, no choice.
Have the house sale papers come already? Has she signed? I don't know. Sometimes I doze and don't hear everything. and I don't care. Having nothing myself, property is not my concern. Skyscrapers, tin shacks, and all the bridges and temples in between, keep them. My interest is strictly postpartum, the departing hoof mark in the rock, the bleeding lamb drifting skyward, always up. Hot air without a balloon. Take me with you, chuck the ballast. Give me my go, my afterlife, paradise on earth, even a hell, a 13th floor. I can take it. I believe in life after birth, though I know that separating hope from fact is hard. Something short of eternity will do. 70? Wrap them up, I'll take them. On hope, I've been hearing about the latest slaughters in pursuit of dreams of the life beyond. Mayhem in this world, bliss in the next. Fresh-bearded young men with beautiful skin and long guns on Boulevard Voltaire, gazing into the beautiful, disbelieving eyes of their own generation. It wasn't hatred that killed the innocents, but faith, that famished ghost, still revered, even in the mildest quarters. Long ago, someone pronounced groundless certainty a virtue. Now, the politest people say it is. I've heard their Sunday morning broadcasts from cathedral precincts. Europe's most virtuous spectres, religion, and, when it faltered, godless utopias, bursting with scientific proofs. Together, they scorched the earth from the 10th to the 20th centuries. Here they come again, risen in the east, pursuing their millennium, teaching toddlers to slit the throats of teddy bears. And here I am, with my homegrown faith in the life beyond. I know it's more than a radio program. The voices I hear are not, or not only, in my head. I believe my time will come. I'm virtuous too. The morning is without event. Trudy and Claude's exchange of muted acrimony falters, then yields to hours of sleep, after which she leaves him in bed and takes a shower. In the thrumming warmth of speeding droplets and the sound of my mother's tuneful humming, I experience an unaccountable mood of joy and excitement. I can't help myself. I can't hold the happiness back. Are these borrowed hormones? It hardly matters. I see the world as golden, even though the shade is no more than a name. I know it's along the scale near yellow, also just a word, but golden sounds right. I sense it. I taste it where hot water cascades across the back of my skull. I don't remember such carefree delight. I'm ready. I'm coming. The world will catch me, tend to me, because it can't resist me. Wine by the glass rather than the placenta. Books direct by lamplight. Music by Bach. Walks along the shore, kissing by moonlight. Everything I've learnt so far says all these delights are inexpensive, achievable, ahead of me. Even when the roaring water ceases, when we step into colder air and I'm shaken to a blur by Trudy's towel, I have the impression of singing in my head. Choirs of angels. Another hot day, another floating confection, so I dream of printed cotton, yesterday's sandals, no scent because her soap, if it's the bar Claude gave her, is perfumed with gardenia and patchouli. She doesn't braid today. Instead, two plastic devices, highly coloured, I'm sure, attached above her ears, hold her hair back on each side. I feel my spirits begin to droop as we descend the familiar stairs. Just now, to have forgotten my father for minutes on end. We enter a clean kitchen, whose unnatural order is my mother's night tribute to him, her exequy. The acoustic is altered, the floor no longer sticks to her sandals. The flies have moved to other heavens. As she goes towards the coffee machine, she must be thinking, as I am, that Elodie will have finished her interview. The officers of the law will be confirming or abandoning